Well, my friends, if you haven't already, please open your Bibles to Genesis 49. If you'd like to actually have a physical Bible and you didn't bring one or you don't have one, there should be some in the seats in front of you, and we're going to be on page 43. Or if you're using a smartphone, if you're using a tablet, if you're using a device, as always, I want to encourage you to open to Genesis 49. As you're opening there, this is our last Sunday in the book of Genesis. So we have been in the book of Genesis for a little more than a calendar year. We started it last June. We're finishing it up this June. So this is our last Sunday in the book of Genesis. Now, what's going to happen is next Sunday, we're going to have the district superintendent of the EFCA Rocky Mountain District. Bethany is a part of the Association of E-Free Churches. And our district superintendent, Dr. Greg Fell, he's going to be out here and he's going to be preaching on the resurrection. And basically, he's going to be looking at, hey, here's this central thing we believe. We sang it in this song today, the central thing Christians believe. How have we come to that belief? And are there strong foundations for standing on that belief? So he's going to be out here next week looking at that. In 2 weeks, on the first Sunday in July, we're going to be doing a joint worship service with our sister Spanish language congregation, Vida Nueva Para Denver. So it's going to be awesome. The place is going to be packed. It's going to be rocking. There's going to be a ton of amazing food afterwards. You're welcome to join us for food afterwards. But we're going to be doing a joint service with the people of Vida Nueva. Same time, still at 10:45, all that same stuff. But they're going to be joining us. And we love doing that because it helps us stay close to them as a church. It helps our churches from drifting to stay united. And it's this awesome picture of what God intends for the world, which is people of every nation, of every language, gathered together in worship around Jesus. So that's what we've got in 2 weeks. And then in 3 weeks, we're going to begin 3 months going through the book of James. So one of our beliefs as a church, one of our values is an open Bible, because we believe that in the Bible we hear the voice of God. And so we want to set aside time to preach through books of the Bible, because we believe that it's just going through what God has passed down to us that we're going to be able to hear his voice in that. So that's what we have coming. But today we have our very last Sunday in Genesis. And we've been doing a series called Cowboy Up. We've said that you could sum up the theme of many of these final passages of Genesis with this idea of cowboy up. It's a rodeo phrase that means to get tough. It's when you get bucked off a horse and you've got to be tough, you've got to get back on, and you've got to keep going. And that's what we're looking at in Genesis 49. Now, I have to tell you, on Thursday, I was standing out under that shelter over there. You can look, you can see it out the window. And as I looked into our parking lot, this is what I saw. Now, the right question in your head should be, what happened? And I will confess to you that when I went home that night and I showed this to my wife and she said, what happened? I told her, I was like, well, you know, I leaned on it a little too strong. You know, been a little bit of those curls. And what actually happened is we just had a couple good gusts of wind. There was a little bit of rain, a couple good gusts of wind. And you could hear a crack like a branch was breaking off. And then nothing for about a minute. And then you could hear a crack like a branch was breaking off. I thought maybe branches were hitting the roof of the building. And then all of a sudden you hear crack, 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 crack. And I look over and this guy just goes down. And I was actually working on this text when that happened. And it made me think, I don't want to be like that tree. I don't want it to be where you get some gusts of wind, and that blows me over. See, maybe you're like this. I want to be the kind of man that I can stand on my convictions, even when it takes courage to do it. I want to be the kind of man where I stand on my convictions, and even when winds from the world or from society come, that I'm not going to get blown over like that, that I'm going to stand and not move. And some of you are going to be like this too, I want to be a man who's brave in my faith, that I can stand strong in my faith. Yes, this is what I believe. This is how I'm going to live, and nothing's going to move me off of that. I'm not going to let myself get blown over. I'm not going to be like this tree. So I don't want to be like that, and maybe you don't want to be like that either. I know Bethany as a church, doesn't want to be like this tree. We want to stand courageously on our convictions. We want to live our faith, even when living our faith means going into a wind that's trying to blow us over. And what we see at the beginning, or excuse me, at the end of Genesis 29, is a man living this kind of faith, is a man living these kinds of courageous convictions. See, if you look at Genesis 49, beginning in verse 29, we've reached a point where a man named Jacob is dying. Jacob's life has been the subject of like half of the book at Genesis, but by this point, he's an elderly man. He's in Egypt. He's not from Egypt, but he's in Egypt, and he's getting ready to pass away, and he calls his sons around him, and he says this in verse 29. I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field at Machpelah, to the east of Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. Now that maybe doesn't sound like he's being all that brave. That maybe doesn't sound like he's really standing on his convictions or he's practicing big faith. But here's what we know about this guy named Jacob. Jacob was born in what was then called the land of Canaan, a land compromising today modern-day Israel and Jordan and Syria. And God had promised Jacob, you are going to have this land. Back in Genesis 28, verses 13 through 15, God said this to Jacob. He said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. Notice the land again, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. So Jacob has this promise from God. He believes in this promise of God. But now he's not in the land of Canaan. He's in the land of Egypt, and he's going to die. And the easy thing would be for him to be buried in Egypt. First of all, his son Joseph is one of the highest-ranking ministers in Egypt, so he could get a great funeral. Number two, the Egyptians are really good at funerals. You've all seen pictures of the pyramids, yes? Those are big tombs. The Egyptians did funerals right. And so Jacob can stay in Egypt, he can have this amazing funeral, he can be laid to rest in an amazing tomb in a day when many of the people believed that the quality of your tomb determined the quality of your afterlife. He could be laid to rest in that kind of tomb. But notice what he says instead. Look again at Genesis 49:29. He says, I'm going to be gathered to my people, bury me with my fathers in what? In the cave. He's forgoing a tomb in Egypt, the best tombs you can get in this day, for a cave in a little backwater land. And the whole reason he wants it is because of faith, because God has said, you're going to have this land, and you're going to have great people, and I will make this happen. And he's basically saying, he's going, God has promised this to me, he's going to do it one day, and dang it, I want to be there when he does it, so get me up there and bury me there. That's big faith. So the story starts with the kind of faith that I want to have, with the kind of courage to stand on convictions I want to have, that maybe you want to have. But God is aware that it's not always easy to have that kind of faith. God is aware that it's not always easy to be courageous and stand on those convictions. So what we then get in Genesis, after Jacob commands his sons to do this, and in verse 33, after he drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people, what we get after Jacob dies are two stories. And what these stories are meant to do is to show us the character of God so that we can better trust God and better have faith, even when that wind is blowing and threatening to blow us over. You know, one of the things I love is when I'm doing interviews, when I'm looking at hiring people, I love asking questions that start like this. Tell me about a time when. Because what I want to hear is I want to hear somebody tell me a story. Because I know as I hear people's stories, I'm going to start to get a glimpse at people's character. And as I get those glimpses of their character, I'm going to start to figure out whether or not I want to actually trust this individual. And that's what's going to happen in this next section of Genesis. We're going to get some stories so that we can get glimpses of God's character so you can decide, hey, can I trust this God to step out in these acts of faith that maybe following him would call me to do? Now we get the first story beginning in verse 1 in chapter 50. In verse 1 in chapter 50, it says this: "Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over his father and kissed his father." Now pause there. We're going to go back to the next two verses. That sounds insignificant, but what we see right away, moments after Jacob's death, is God reliably keeping his promises to Jacob. Because see, in Genesis 46:4, God spoke to Jacob. At this point, in Genesis 46:4, Jacob is an elderly man. He's back in the land he was born in, but there's a famine in the land. His family's struggling. They don't know how they're going to make it. And they find out that Joseph, who Jacob thought was dead for 17 years, Joseph is a high-ranking minister in Egypt. They're invited to come to Egypt. And so Jacob's seeing a way to save his family, but he stops at the border. Because you can understand how somebody who is advanced in years is looking at moving to a new culture, a new language, a new land, and there's anxiety in that. And at that time, God comes to Jacob and he says, "I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes." Remember, Jacob at this point has thought Joseph was dead for the past 17 years. It's been a very, very short matter of time that he's actually known that Joseph is alive, and he hasn't seen him. He's just heard his son say, "Hey, we went to Egypt and we found Joseph was living there and he was the brother and he wants us to come down there." And you can understand how Jacob could maybe be thinking, this is a trap, this is a ruse, something is not above level with this. And so into that, God promises, "Joseph will close your eyes." And now look again at chapter 50, verse 1, and you see the importance where it says, "Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him." Because moments after Jacob's death, God is reliably keeping a promise to Jacob. That theme keeps going as we look at verse 2. "Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father." So the physicians embalmed him. 40 days were required for it, for that is how many are required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. That's probably the 40 days for embalming and the typical Hebrew, which is what Jacob was, typical Hebrew, 30 days for mourning. But the importance of that is this is a hot climate, and Jacob wants his corpse transferred far away. The embalming is showing Joseph's intent to actually take the corpse to where it's meant to go. So Joseph is going to hopefully fulfill the promise that his dad asked of him, but there's a complication. Look at verse 4. "When the days of weeping for Jacob were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, 'If now I have found favor in my father's eyes, please speak in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, I am about to die in my tomb that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan. There shall you bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, then I'll return.'" Pharaoh is the ruler of Egypt. Joseph is a powerful man in Egypt, but he's not from Egypt. And so he has to ask permission to go on this journey. If we think about modern immigration policy, we can start to see why. It's possible Joseph could leave and go on this journey, and then his family might not be permitted back into Egypt, where they're building a life. And so this is a big deal. If Pharaoh says no, all of a sudden, what's going to happen? Is Jacob going to get buried where he wanted to? Is he going to have to linger in Egypt? There's not a given here that this is going to happen. And so what we see is God moving behind the scenes to again fulfill a promise for Jacob when we read in verse 6 of chapter 50. "Pharaoh answered, 'Go up and bury your father as he made you swear.'" We read that God promised Jacob, "I will bring you up again to rest in this land." And here we see God working behind the scenes so that Jacob's family is able to bring him up to rest in the land. And when they do, it's not just them who go. Look at what comes in verse 7. Notice how the Egyptians mourn too. So Joseph went up to bury his father, but with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household and all the elders of Egypt, as well as the household of Joseph and his brothers, his father's household. Their children and their flocks and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. That showed they intended to return. But there they went up with him with both chariots and horsemen. It was a great company when they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan in the land of Canaan. They lamented there with a very great and grievous lamentation, and he made a mourning for his father 7 days. Notice that it says in verse 10, not just he lamented, but they lamented. The Egyptians are mourning Jacob as well. That's important because way back in Genesis 12, verses 1 through 2, God spoke a promise to Jacob's grandfather Abraham that would be passed on through the family. God said this to Abraham. He said, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. Here come the promises. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will make your name great. Now look again at chapter 50, and what do you see? You see that Jacob's name was meant so great that the Egyptians are mourning him as well. In fact, they're mourning him so much. Look at verse 11. The natives in the land, they don't look at this and go, oh, this is a Hebrew funeral. They think this is an Egyptian state funeral. Verse 11, when the inhabitants of the land of Canaan saw the mourning on the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning by the Egyptians. What we're seeing is that God promised Jacob, I will make your name great. His name has been made so great that when he passes away, Egyptian dignitaries travel far out of the land to mourn him so that people in the land go, somebody important in Egypt must have died. And what we see in the beginning of chapter 50 is that God is again and again and again reliably fulfilling his promise to Jacob. That's what 12 through 14 will finish unpacking, that Jacob will in fact be buried in the land. And so what we're seeing in this repeatedly, even after Jacob's life is over, is this. We're seeing that God is reliable. We're seeing that God is reliable, that he keeps the promises he said he would keep. It's actually very important to notice this too, that these promises are all being fulfilled after Jacob dies. That's important for two reasons. First reason, it's showing that not even death can prevent God from reliably keeping his promises. If death isn't big enough to keep God from doing it, nothing is going to be big enough to keep God from doing it. That's the first important reason. Here's a second one. You will sometimes come across people, I came across this a lot, who will say, you know, the Old Testament really isn't concerned with life after death. It's not really in there. That was something that the Jewish people were just exposed to later, and so they started changing their thinking to bring that in. But that's really not part of the Old Testament. Well, here you see in the first book of the Bible, the story going out of its way to say, hey, God fulfills his promises. Death might come and intervene. That's not going to stop God. This whole thing is about what happens after a person dies. And so we see those two key points as it's showing us that God is reliable. And so can we trust God? Can we step out in big faith like Jacob did? Can we courageously stand on our convictions? And what Genesis is answering is you can do that because God is reliable. But what does that look like? I have a group on Tuesday mornings where every other Tuesday I get to meet with a handful of senior women. And we just read through passages that are going to be preached in Bethany. And I'll tell them, I'm going to read through some of this, I'm going to tell you some of my thoughts, and my goal is just to sit back and be quiet and see what I can learn from you ladies. And as we were reading through this one the past week, some of the ladies were sharing stories on this. Because I asked, I said, in your own life, how have you seen God be reliable? If somebody came to you and said, you're telling me God is reliable, why do you believe that? What would you say to them? This is what one of the ladies had to say in answer to that question.
I think I've seen it most in loss. My first baby died at 2 months, but I wasn't a mother until after I lost that baby. It drew my husband and I close together in our grief. Later, my father died. I was mad at God for 2 years. I had two young children by that time. He'd waited to be a grandfather. Gradually, God led me back to him to accept his will. Several years later, my mother died, and my mother-in-law was very ill. I had to have time to process my mother's death, and it was 3 years later that my mother-in-law died. You have to have time to process each crisis so they don't build up and they become too much to bear. Much later, my children grown, my husband of 48 years died. I could gather all of those losses together and it wouldn't touch the loss of my husband. I thought I knew what trust was. I had no clue. Gradually, over months, years, God directed my focus away from my grief, my loss, onto my Lord, and a love for his word. Have I had one long life of loss and tears? Of course not. I've had joys that were wonderful, but I learned the most in my losses, more sense of his presence, his sovereignty, his grace, and his strength, which I pray for daily as I age. He is faithful, and he always keeps his promises.
So we read it in Genesis, but you can hear in Jane's story as well. God is reliable. Even when death enters into the picture, even when death enters in, even on the other side of that, God shows himself to be reliable. And that becomes a foundation for courageously standing on convictions for great faith. That's the first story we get in this section of Genesis. But then we get another story as well. So beginning in verse 15, Joseph's brothers get a little worried. Early, many years ago, Joseph's brothers had beaten him and had sold him into slavery. And now that their father's gone, they're a little worried that retribution might be coming. So in verse 15, it says, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, it could be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him. So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgressions of the servant of God, your father. Now Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. And you can tell they're trying to make sure they don't get into trouble. But notice what Joseph says in verse 19. He says, do not fear. Am I in the place of God? What he's saying there is that this wasn't my doing. This was God's doing. Verse 20, here's why. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. Joseph there is affirming that even in the midst of all the evil that came on him, that God was in control. We see that God is in control. If we wanted to use the theological word for it, we could say God is sovereign. And if you prefer that word, that's fine. But that's what it means. It means God's in control. He can do as he sees fit. He's in control. And that's what Jacob is affirming. My brothers did this terrible stuff to me, but even in the midst of it, it wasn't foiling God's plan. He was still in control of what happened. But he wasn't just in control. See, someone being in control just means they're powerful, but power can be used for good or for bad. What completes this is what comes at the rest of verse 20. God meant it for good to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So don't fear, I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Joseph recognizes God isn't just in control, but God is interested in blessing humanity. God isn't just in control. God is interested in blessing humanity. He's using the fact that he's in control to work what's happening to Joseph for good, to work to keep people alive, to work to bless humanity. And actually, you have a microcosm here in the book of Genesis, of the whole book of Genesis, because you have the brothers scheming, but Joseph saying, no, God's desire, despite your scheming, is to bless. That's the whole book of Genesis. It opens with God creating and blessing and people scheming and messing it up. And the rest of the book is a story of people scheming and God going even further to bless them still. And so we see that God's in control. We see that God is interested in blessing humanity. And you have to have those two going together. If you want a picture of the fact you have to have those two going together, imagine going in to a hospital for surgery. Imagine going in to a doctor who very much wants your good, but has no idea how to perform surgery. You would sprint out of there. But now imagine going in and you've got a doctor who perfectly knows how to do surgery, but you're not all that convinced he has your good at heart. And you're not so sure you want to let somebody drug you, put you under, and then take a knife and start cutting and meddling with the stuff in your body, because that sounds a lot like what some of the shady criminal stories we hear on Dateline do. See, it only works when you have control and a desire to work good together. And that's what we see here. Now, that may raise the question, if God's in control and if God desires to work good, why is there all this stuff going wrong? Why aren't we seeing it happening now? Why isn't God getting rid of all the bad things? Why isn't God getting rid of injustice? Why isn't God getting rid of suffering? Why isn't God making this a place where people live in peace and joy around Him? We actually have a name for a place like that. We call it heaven. And that's exactly what God is doing right now, is He's bringing us to that place. And like in surgery, there's pain and hurt as the surgeon is bringing us from a place of sickness to a place of health. God, being in control and desiring to bless humanity, is bringing us from a place of sickness to the place we call heaven. You know, there's a story told of a young boy in the 70s or 80s who had just a bad, bad disease. And so 3-4 years old, he's having to go to the hospital, and he has to get a spinal tap, which is where somebody has to stick a needle into the fluid around his spine and draw it out. And the mom before this procedure explains to the boy and says, this is going to hurt. This is going to be bad. But please remember that everything the doctor's doing, he's doing because he loves you. Even if the doctor makes you hurt, he's doing it because he loves you and wants you to be better. So the day of the procedure comes, and it's terrible. The little boy is screaming, crying, kicking. It takes 3 nurses to hold him down. And by the time they finally finish, the little kid is covered in sweat. He's breathing hard. There are tears running down his cheeks. But the doctor hears him gasp out and go, doctor. And he looks at the little boy, and the little boy goes, doctor, thank you for my hurting. Because God is in control, because God is interested in blessing humanity, if you choose to walk by faith in Him, you will have a day, someday, where you will be able to say, God, thank you for my hurting. That's not to make light of the hurting. The hurting is real. The hurting is intense. The hurting is big. But God is in control. God is interested in blessing humanity. Because of that, we can trust Him. We can step out in faith in Him, knowing who it is we're stepping out in faith in. And so Genesis gives us those characters of God to encourage us. Yes, stand courageously on your convictions. Yes, even when the wind is blowing, step out in faith, trusting God. And it actually then invites us to it explicitly. Look at the very end of Genesis, beginning in verse 22. It says, Joseph remained in Egypt. He and his father's house, Joseph lived 110 years, and Joseph saw Ephraim's children, his son's children, to the third generation. The children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, these are great-grandchildren, were counted as Joseph's own. And Joseph said to his brothers, hear the faith. I am about to die, but God will visit you and will bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely visit you and will carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Do you hear the 2 challenges to faith in that? Number one, there's the challenge of Joseph's example, where he says in 24, I'm going to die, but God will come to you. He'll bring you out of this land, and when he does, you take me too. Joseph is practicing the same faith as his father Jacob. He's saying, I know I could be buried in a tomb in Egypt. I don't want a tomb in Egypt. I trust someday God is going to do what he said in the land. I want to be there when it happens. And so Genesis ends with an example of faith, asking the readers, asking God's people throughout history, will you also walk in that kind of faith? And it asks it fairly specifically when Joseph says in verse 25, God will surely visit you, carry up my bones from there. It's asking the first readers, will you be faithful and walk with God and someday go back to the land when God gives you that opportunity and bring Jacob's bone or Joseph's bones there? Genesis is ending with an invitation to faith. It's ending with an invitation. Will you step out in faith as God leads? Like Jacob did, like Joseph did, will you trust? And there's two elements to that trust too, because faith takes place in two ways. Now they're related, you can't have one without the other, but faith takes place in two ways. There's a faith of belief. Will you step out in faith and believe the things God says are true, the things about Him, the things about Jesus, the things about you, the things about people, the things about our world and our society? It gets hard around, will you believe what God says about marriage, about gender, about sexuality, about justice, about all of those kind of things? When God invites you to faith, He's inviting you to a faith of belief. And having faith and believing those things can make you hated and considered one of the worst people in our society. And yet Genesis is inviting you to practicing faith in your belief. And it's inviting you to practice faith in your behavior, in how you live. God calls us to forgive liberally, to give graciously to His work, to be patient, to love our enemies, to pray for those who would do us harm. Those are acts of faith that aren't easy to do. Genesis is asking, will you step out in faith and live the way God has said is the righteous, the right way to live? You know, one of the things that gives us trouble on that is I think we often want to understand before we step out in faith. We say, God, you're asking me to believe this, but it doesn't make sense. Help me understand, and then I'll believe that. I have sat in the middle of the night under one light at a kitchen table with a Bible open before me, pounding on it, saying just that. God, I don't understand why it would be like this, and I can't believe it would be like this. And we want to understand. God calls us. God leads you to do something big, and you think God might be doing it, but you're going, God, I don't understand how that would work. I don't see how you could ever make that happen. I don't know why you would ask me to do this. And we want to understand before we step out in faith. But what we're doing is getting it backwards. Because look again at Genesis 50. Look again at verse 24. When Joseph says, I'm going to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land, he doesn't know how God's going to do that. He has no idea how God is going to make that happen. He's not seeking to understand in order to have faith. He's saying, I have faith and trusting that somehow then he and his descendants will understand what God is doing. You know, in the 4th and 5th century, there was a Christian man who lived in North Africa. His name was Augustine. He started early in his life traveling all through the Mediterranean world, trying every different philosophy of life he could find. The way we would say it's now, he visited every self-help guru and every spiritual counselor he could find. And he left all of them frustrated, feeling like he was empty, that it was just, it wasn't there, until he had an experience of God speaking to him audibly through a child's voice, telling him to read the Bible. And that experience launched him into becoming one of the greatest Christian thinkers in church history. And as he reflected on this Christian faith and how he came to faith, this is what he counseled others who were seeking spiritually. He said this. He said, seek not to understand that you may believe, but believe that you may understand. Seek not to understand that you may believe, but believe that you may understand. Augustine was saying, often we go, I want to understand before I step out in faith. But what's true is that it's once we step out in faith that we're able to begin understanding. And so as God invites you in Genesis 50 to step out in faith, wherever that might be, in your beliefs, in your behaviors, somewhere else, as God invites you to step out into faith, you may not understand why he's inviting you there, but step out there anyway, not seeking to understand that you may believe, but instead step out and believe, and you'll see how God opens your mind so you can understand. And if that's hard, if you find that challenging, if you reach a point where you go, that's great that God is in control and that's great that God is interested in blessing humanity, and that's great that God is reliable, but I can't quite bring myself to step out with understanding. If you find yourself in that place, look to the cross. If you find yourself in that place, look to the cross. Because we read that God is reliable, and on the cross we see that God is so reliable that to fulfill his promises, he would be willing to send his only son to be arrested, beaten, nailed to a cross so that he could keep his promises to you. We read that God is in control, and on the cross we see that God could take one of the worst devices of torture human beings have ever cooked up, one of the cruelest ways we've ever found to end a life, and is so in control, he could use it to give eternal life to all the nations. We read that God is interested in blessing humanity, and on the cross we see that God is so committed to that that he would give his only begotten son that whoever should believe in him would not perish but have eternal life. And so if you struggle in times when God is asking you to step out in faith in your belief, step out in faith in your behavior, if you struggle to believe that he's reliable, that he's in control, that he's interested in blessing humanity, look to the cross. Now maybe you go, well, how do I know all those things actually happened? You come here next Sunday and you hear Dr. Fell talk about it. But for today, just know when you struggle to answer the call of Genesis 50, look to the cross. See there the character of God so that you can take that leap of faith. Not because you understand and you see, but because you trust in the one who's calling you to jump. You know, there's a story told of a young boy whose house caught on fire one night. And by the way, I'm sorry, I know it's Father's Day. I don't know why this is like horrible stories involving young boys' day, but this story is told of this young boy whose house caught on fire, and he was able to escape up to the roof, to part overhanging it, and so there's more house behind him on fire, but he's on, you know, one of the roof over the first floor, and he's trying to figure out what to do, and his dad gets down to the ground level, and as his dad looks up through the smoke and everything, he can see the boy lit up by the fire behind him. And so the dad starts yelling at his son, jump, jump, I will catch you, run over here and jump, I'm right under you. But the little boy, as he looks, he's terrified, and all he can see is smoke. And he gets to the edge, but he can't bring himself to do it. And he looks at it, and so he yells at his dad, and he goes, I can't jump. I can't see you. All I see is smoke. I can't see you. And his dad yells up to him, and he goes, I know, but I can see you. When you struggle to jump in faith when God is calling you to, whether that's to take the first step of faith to believe in Jesus and receive eternal life, whether that's you've walked in faith for 60 years and God is calling you to a final one, when you struggle to take the jump of faith because you can't see and can't understand, look to the cross and hear in it the message of Genesis 50. You can't see, but God can see you. And take the jump of faith. You know, we get the opportunity today to celebrate communion, to take bread that is broken to symbolize the body of Christ being broken upon the cross, and to take a cup that symbolizes the blood of Christ being shed upon the cross. And so as I ask the communion servers to come forward, I'm going to invite you shortly to come up and to share in communion. And as you do so, as you take what symbolizes the body of Christ shed for you, as you take what symbolizes the blood of Christ shed for you, take it again as a sign of God saying to you that he sees you and that you can step out in faith in him. And so we'll have servers in the middle. Servers, if you want to come grab the stuff, we'll have servers in the middle. You'll receive a piece of bread. And you'll be able to dunk it. You can either take it there or you can go back to your seat. You can also come and serve yourself at the table, serve your family. There's some gluten-free options because we want everyone to be able to take of communion. But I invite you, come up and take this even as an act of faith. Maybe your first act of faith. Maybe this is your way of coming forward and saying, I do believe in Jesus. I am going to step out in faith in him. If you're not there yet, I would encourage you not to come forward today, but to ask God to show himself, to show his character so that you can take that step of faith. And before you come up, after you come up, whichever one it is, I invite you, if there's anywhere that God is working in you now, is calling you to an act of faith, take time to pray and affirm with him today that you will take that step of faith and ask him to give you understanding so that you can be bold in doing so.